everyone. Thank you for coming out on this chilly, wet day. Good day to be indoors, sitting together. And welcome to our annual Dogen retreat. I did not consult the archives, but this might be about the sixth one. I'm not sure. Michael and I take turns every other year. And we used to call these study retreats, but we stopped, we dropped the word study because we didn't want to scare people off. There's not going to be an exam. And also because it's not study in the academic sense. Although each time we choose a section from, or a fascicle from Dogen's Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, we want to engage with these texts in a way that illuminates our practice, right on the ground practice. When I use that word fascicle, it means that this two-volume in English translation work of Dogen's writing, that the sections aren't chapters per se. They were written each separately and then compiled after Dogen's death, approximately in the order that they were written. And there are different versions. So that's why I'm calling them fascicles. For those of you who are new, Dogen Zenji. Zenji means Zen master, Zen teacher, and Dogen was his Dharma name. Was the founder of our school of Zen in Japan in the 13th century. He was born in 1200, and when he was only in his very early 20s, he went to China. Because he wasn't satisfied with the practice he'd been doing since he was about 13 as a young monk. And he met his teacher there. He stayed about 5 years in China and met his teacher Ru Jing, who taught him this particular style of Zen practice, which was very meaningful to him. A style of Zen practice that where Zazen is the actual practice of sitting, meditation is central and also permeates every possible aspect of our life. So Dogen came back to Japan and he first set himself up in a little hermitage and just a few people started to come and practice with him on the outskirts of Kyoto. And then he started a small monastery training monks, but he was persecuted. The monastery was persecuted by the establishment, the Kyoto Tendai School, which is where Dogen started. It was very powerful, and they had warrior monks, and they were very allied with the elite. Power structure and the nobility in Kyoto, and they were threatened by this young upstart who wanted to practice in a different way. So so Dogen retreated into the mountains northwest of Kyoto and started a monastery called Eiheiji, which exists to this day. Some of us have been there. Very beautiful, deep in the mountains. But this particular text that we're going to look at today, he wrote before that. He wrote it, I believe, in 1240. So he would have been 40 years old when he wrote this text. In an earlier text called Genjo Koan, which is usually translated, one way it's translated is actualizing the fundamental point or the fundamental koan of our practice, fundamental question. how do we actualize that in our practice? He wrote, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized or illuminated by the 10,000 things. So this is the sense that in which we're going to study this text. We're going to study it by when we sit in Zazen looking at our lives as they manifest in each moment. And when we do that, our sense of our concrete everyday self starts to dissolve, starts to drop away. And the 10,000 things, which is everything, comes forward to meet us in a different way, in a way where we're directly connected with the divide, the barriers between self and world, thin and dissolve. And we see our true nature, we see the true nature of being. So that's the sense in which we're going to study, even though we're going to use Dogen's words. Dogen likes to kind of use words and then subvert words to get us to study in that deep way. Dogen's what's called his masterwork, this collection of writings. There are others, but this one in particular is called the Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And these traditional study retreats where we read from the Shobo Genzo are called Genzo-e. Ge-e means gathering, so it's a gathering to I like to think of it as a gathering to open our Dharma eye together. So this time, I decided to tackle the fascicle called Uji, or Being Time. It's one of the best known and most philosophical of Dogen's writing. It's about the nature of being and time. And I partly chose it because I was curious to read two newly published commentaries on it. One by Shinshu Roberts, who's a woman priest and teacher in our lineage, San Francisco Zen Center lineage. And she draws on every bit of commentary and writing that she could get her hands on in English. She doesn't read the original. So she did a lot of work and synthesized a lot of work here. So I was curious to see what she had to say. And then also this book, which is three fascicles from the Shobo Genzo, translated by Daitsu Tom Wright and Shohaku Okumura, who were Michael's and my first Soto Zen teachers in Japan back in the mid-1980s. So, and they're still very dear to our hearts, particularly Shohaku Okumura, who teaches now in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana. So the two others plus Uji are in here with their translation and commentary by their teacher Uchiyama Roshi, who's no longer living. We never met him, but he's a really wonderful Japanese teacher, and what of his writing is available in English is quite really worth acquainting yourself with. I will always be grateful for that start in Kyoto with Shohaku and Tom. Dogen Zen, it was sort of like they just, or particularly Shohaku, just kind of read Dogen and commented a little, and then we just sat and sat and sat. And Dogen Zen was revelatory to me then and continues to be so in my practice today. Dogen's writings can be pretty forbidding at first. They can seem abstruse and impenetrable. But the more you become acquainted with them, the more Dogen you read, the more certain phrases, concepts, themes start to interweave between the writings and support each other. And he uses many, many of the traditional Zen koans and stories, teaching stories, weaves them in. And so it's a kind of cumulative effect please don't try really hard to understand Dogen. You'll just make yourself crazy.
Yeah.
Allow it to penetrate the way poetry does, through repeated readings. You know, just something will just open up or spark some insight, or the words will penetrate in some way this time. And then, you know, maybe a few years from now, you'll revisit the same text and something else will come up very strongly for you. So please don't worry about understanding Dogen in our conventional way. Uchiyama Roshi reminds us that everything Dogen says in Uji, in this fascicle, and other writings, boils down to our actual experience of Zazen. Paying attention to our lives, just as they are, right now. And then, right now. He says in the commentary, what we find in this fascicle Uji is certainly not anything that is difficult nor something mystically profound. What is written is about nothing other than the most natural scenery of our Zazen. This teaching is one that enables us to move that much deeper, into our very ordinary way of practice. That is, it is not some ideal or abstract explanation unrelated to our everyday lives. So with that reminder, let's begin at the beginning with the title, Uji. Here it is. And Michael did some calligraphy for us. And there's a copy for each of you to take home.
Oh, wow.
Oh. Yeah. Thanks to the copy machine. But he individually stamped them. So, Uji, two characters. First one's being, and the second one's time. It can be read two ways. Given the Japanese reading, you could read this arutoki. And aru might be written not with this Chinese character, but it might be written aru, or maybe just with the ru, as in a phonetic script that's part of Japanese as well. It's a little complicated, but it's an interesting digression, so I'll digress. When Japanese culture first encountered Chinese culture, Japan had no written language. And so they started using Chinese sort of like Latin was used in Europe as the official language, the language of documents and government. Japanese and Chinese are really different grammatically. So when the time came that, and this actually was, women were very involved in creating the first Japanese texts written in colloquial Japanese. And there was a phonetic script developed to be used, women used it because they often weren't necessarily educated in Chinese, but also to express grammatical parts like verb endings, prepositions that don't exist in Chinese. So Japan developed the most complicated writing system in the world because they would have been better off phonetically encountering the Roman alphabet, but they didn't. So that's a roundabout way of saying that this can be read two ways. It can be read Uji, which is derived from the Chinese pronunciation, or Arutoki, which would be the Japanese. And Arutoki in today, even in colloquial Japanese, would mean once or at one time, or even once upon a time. Arutoki, right? But these express the sense of a period of time that occurred in the past, and it's over, right? And that is not Dogen's meaning here. A number of translations translate this uji as for the time being. In fact, the one I've just given you does. And I, again, that expresses for the time being the sense of temporary duration, right? Colloquially. And again, that's not Dogen's meaning. So I prefer, Dogen is using a compound, Chinese characters, uji, and so I prefer to make an English compound noun, being time, hyphenated. Because I think that's the closest to the sense that Dogen is using here. So, you're going to see that in this translation. I have substituted being time, hyphenated, every time it says for the time being. I put for the time being in parentheses. So when we read this, we're going to say being time. So bear with me on that, because I think that will help us. This is Dogen's meditation on the nature of being and time. When you think of time, what comes to mind?
Clock.
Past and future.
What are some of the colloquial expressions we use to describe our relationship to time?
I don't have enough time.
Time is money.
Time flies.
Time flies, yeah. Time's up. Time waits for no man. Right? What else?
Waste of time.
Time and time again.
Killing time. Right? Just killing time. Wasting time. No time to lose. Listen to all that. You know?
Currency. It's like currency.
Yeah. We want to quantify it. We want to put value, monetary value on it.
Scarce resource.
And then there are those cheery aphorisms. Be here now. Live in the moment. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. You heard these?
That's very deep. I've learned all that.
These have become cliches in our time, right? And yet everything in our cultural environment conspires to obstruct receiving the gift of the present. The mind is so strongly habituated not to be still. We say, well, I'm going to sit here and follow my breath. And the mind says, excuse me, I have work to do. I have to replay that meeting yesterday to see what I should have said. And I have to worry about that job interview next week. And by the way, remember how your mother or your father said you're never going to amount to anything? Well, no wonder you're such a mess. No wonder you can't meditate. How can you pay attention to your breath with all that going on? Not so easy. Well, the wonderful thing about this practice is that you can. You actually can, with practice, you can establish a foundation of mindfulness of breath and body from which you can expand your awareness to include all that mess, everything that manifests in your experience moment to moment, including the past and the future, which are present in each moment when you look deeply into the nature of time. And that's what Dogen's going to tell us about. In Western culture, time is viewed as linear, right? Proceeding from past to present to future. As we said, we like to quantify it. We like to measure it. If we have too much, we're bored. If we don't have enough, we're anxious. The American poet Leah Purpura says this in her poem entitled Time. Having only a little means you take what you've got, or because it's not worth enough, you don't. Like not picking up a penny because it's only a little luck. You know what she means. Oh, I only have half an hour. I'm not going to bother sitting down to write a poem. I need more time than that. Those little excuses we make to not pick up that penny. Yeah. She nailed me with this one. But what if we're wrong about time? What if there's more to it? Other world cultures have different views of time. For the Aymara, who are indigenous people of the high Andes, the past extends out ahead of them and the future behind. So elders asked to describe their traditional culture will gesture out ahead when they're speaking of their grandparents, or even further in the distance to their ancient Inca ancestors. And when they're speaking of passing the traditional knowledge on to their grandchildren, they'll point behind them. Even in English, the language of time can be a little confusing. So if I tell you we're going to have a meeting scheduled for next Wednesday, and I ask you if we can bump the meeting forward a couple of days, what day will it be? Right? Is it going to be Monday or is it going to be Friday? we get that muddled, don't we? Because we're kind of mixing spatial, you know, closer or more distant from me with time. According to the Judeo-Christian tradition, time began when God created the world, which, according to the literal interpretation of the Bible, was about 6,000 years ago. So those dinosaur bones created a problem when we first dug them up. Whereas the scientific estimate is 4.6 billion years for the Earth and 14 billion years for the universe. Christianity, Judaism, and Islam have a linear view of time, which had a beginning and will have an end with the coming or second coming of the Messiah. On the other hand, according to Hindu cosmology, time is cyclic, right? Universes are born, grow, decline, and end infinitely, infinitely cycling. One whole cycle is said to be 4.32 billion years. And we can find this cyclic conception of time in many Buddhist texts, because of course they came from that tradition. But in Uji, Dogen is describing a concept of time that's closer to modern physics. And it also gives us direct guidance about our everyday lives and practice. So let's begin. Take out your copies. This translation is by Kaz Tanahashi. It's not necessarily the best, but some of the more academic translations use language that is even more difficult than Dogen's and not that helpful. Tanahashi's is more accessible and pretty clear, I think, in this case. Except for what I already said, I really don't think that the phrase "the time being" does justice to Dogen's point here. I also took the liberty, because I can't help myself, of retranslating the first verse that begins this passage, this fascicle. So you'll see the verse written as a verse rather than in paragraph form. So see, just then that's my version. And then just below it, and I put it in parentheses, is Kaz's version. So let us read the verse together. Dogen begins by saying, an ancient Buddha said. So here, let's read my version, please. being time, standing on a mountain peak. Being time, going to the depths of the ocean. Being time, a three-headed, eight-armed demon. Being time, a 16-foot standing Buddha, an 8-foot seated Buddha. Being time, a staff, a fly whisk. Being time, a temple pillar, a lantern. Being time, third son of Chang, fourth son of Li. Being time, the great earth, the vast sky. Thank you. That's a pretty literal translation, actually. Dogen doesn't say this, but he just says an ancient Buddha said this, but it was Yaoshan, who was an 8th century Chinese Zen master whose words Dogen borrows in his Dogen's very earliest instructions for Zazen, Fukan Zazengi. Many of you know it. The old story goes like this. So this is from 8th century China. Once a monk came upon Yaoshan sitting in Zazen and asked him, what are you thinking about sitting there so still? Yaoshan said, I am thinking not thinking. How do you think not thinking? The monk asked, quite baffled. Non-thinking, said Yaoshan. So Dogen uses that very question and answer in his instructions for Zazen, and it's good, I think, for us to recall these words at the outset of our retreat. Because it's not that we are trying to force our mind to be free from thoughts. Thoughts naturally arise in the mind. Uchiyama Roshi calls them secretions of the mind. But our practice is not to engage them, not to hold on to them, not to push them away, to allow them to arise and subside like ripples on a pond. And sometimes the pond gets really, really still and quiet, and sometimes it's stirred up because our minds are stirred up, right? But we release. It's like we pay attention without grasping, without pushing away. So these verses in Yaoshan's poem, so it's significant that Dogen chose a poem from Yaoshan, I think. They seem to be in pairs, couplets, and they seem to be expressing opposites. But these pairs are united in being time. Standing on a mountain peak, going to the depths of the ocean. That pair is pretty self-explanatory. We could take that literally, but we could also take it figuratively as the mountaintop being our most exalted higher states of being, and the bottom of the ocean being our unconscious terrors, for example. You know, what we don't know, it's so deeply buried in our lives. So you could take these different ways. A three-headed, eight-armed demon is a representation of a being called an asura. And if you've ever seen the Tibetan images of the six realms, the wheel of life, the six realms, at the top is the heavenly realm, at the bottom is the hell realm, to the right of the hell realm is the realm of the hungry ghosts, beings that are never, they're always hungry, always craving, never satisfied. To the left of the hell realm is the animal realm. So the animal realm is the realm of beings who want what they want when they want it right now. Just doesn't, without regard for others, just give me this. Up to the right of the heavenly realm is the human realm, which is the optimal, said to be the optimal realm for awakening. We have enough self-awareness to do this practice and enough suffering to be forced to pay attention, because the heavenly realm is, there's not enough, there's complacency, right? Oh, I'm so in love, this is such a great relationship. Until, the problem with the heavenly realm, you can tip out of it very, very quickly. And then over on the left, to the other side of the heavenly realm, is the Asura realm. And the Asura is a kind of, they're depicted as a kind of demon. Sometimes they're called fighting titans or angry demigods, and they look very fierce. And please forgive me, I meant to bring my Asura in, and I will promise to do so tomorrow. I have a little Asura who's about this high. And he's kind of orange. Usually they're kind of red. And he's a little plastic figure. very good replica of a very old and quite beautiful image that's in a museum in Nara in Japan. And with the three heads and the eight arms. So I promised to bring my Asura. He's a little plastic figure that I got from vending machine in Japan. Only in Japan would you find a vending machine with Buddhist images, Butsuzo vending machine. They've got action figures and they've got Buddha. and they're, you know, he's beautifully done. So I'll bring him in and put him on the altar for tomorrow, because it's really important that we recognize this realm in our lives, as well as all the others that I just briefly described. But the Asura, you know, they're type A characters, known for their competitiveness, wrath, pride, envy, insincerity, falseness, boasting, bellicosity. They look down on and belittle those they perceive to be beneath them, and that includes just about everybody. And I think this is a particularly pertinent image for our times. Asura. It's spelled A-S-U-R-A, but pronounced Asura. Asura. It's, it's kind of a pertinent image for our times, as the quintessential Asura is the president of a neighboring nation. And the embodiment of this, you know, deeply deluded and self-clinging state. But there have been Asura throughout time. So there have been Roman emperors, you know, especially when empires are crumbling, they arise. I can say this, I feel it's okay to say this in a Dharma talk, because Uchiyama Roshi cites a former prime minister of Japan, Kakue Tanaka, who apparently he said would puff up and turn red when he got mad, and he got in bad trouble for a patronage scandal. So this Asura stands for that element in each one of us, right? Just like we each have a hungry ghost element, you know, never satisfied. We have an Asura element, and you know, some of us kind of like to disown one of these realms more so than another, but they all live in us. As does the 16-foot golden standing Buddha and the 8-foot seated Buddha, our own radiant Buddha nature. We are both Asura and Buddha. And in the flicker of a moment, we can change from one to the other, right? We can drop out of one of those realms into the other, or let go of one and be our radiant Buddha nature. So the next two lines, the staff and the whisk, are kind of accoutrements of a Zen master. The staff is probably the long staff with the six rings on top, the jingle that jingle when you go. And those six rings are the six realms that I just mentioned, by the way. And that staff would traditionally have been used on pilgrimage to warn animals. Not only little animals that you might step on, to let them know you're coming, but also the big scary animals.
It's like a bear bell,
exactly. So that they know. And as we know, we humans are the most dangerous animal on earth. So this is an awareness to let people know, human coming, watch out. And the fly whisk began just as a fly whisk.
Teaching
aid. There it is. And the fly whisk, we didn't bring our whisk. We have our ceremonial whisks, but they're at home. Began just as a fly whisk, but both these items came to have, became ceremonial objects. The next line, the pillars, are the great wooden pillars, sometimes, you know, big old growth trees that support the temple hall. And the lanterns might have been the metal lamps that are on either side of a main altar in China or Japan, or they might be stone lanterns out at the front, at the entrance. Shinshu Roberts, in her book, suggests that the staff and the whisk represent the master, and the pillar and the lantern represent the students or monks in the monastery. Uchiyama Roshi doesn't take that view. He seems to associate the staff and the whisk with an ordinary monk on pilgrimage, wandering in the mountains, and the pillar and lantern as the monastery. Either way, we've got pairs here. And we are both the student and the master, and we are both wandering on pilgrimage and rooted in our place of practice. So the point being, our being includes these opposites, yeah? And the first line of the last couplet refers to the third son of Chang and the fourth son of Li. Chang and Li, or it would be like Smith and Jones. Common names, right? Ordinary names, nobody special. And the third and fourth sons would be undistinguished because they're not going to inherit anything, right? So these represent our ordinary karmic lives, our lives in our particular families of origin, just as we are. And at the same time as we are this particular small, undistinguished person, we are the vast, the great earth, and the boundless sky. So see what he's doing with these pairs? Yeah. So let's keep reading and see what Dogen means by being time. So would someone read the next paragraph, paragraph 2? Yeah, please.
Being time here means time itself is being, and all being is time. A golden 16-foot body is time. Because it is time, there is the radiant illumination of time. Study it as the 12 hours of the present. Three heads and eight arms is time. Because it is time, it is not separate from the 12 hours of the present.
Thank you. So Dogen is saying here that time and being are inextricable, co-arising. Both awakening and illusion manifest in being time in the present moment. Dogen says, study this in the course of your daily life. In his day, one day cycle was divided into 12 periods, so the equivalent of 2 hours of our time. So we divided our day into 24 hours. So he's saying, round the clock, pay attention. Study this in your life. Look deeply. What he's trying to communicate to us is that in each moment, the whole interconnected universe manifests and co-creates our lives. Okay, let's keep going. Somebody read number three. Yeah, Jess.
Even though you do not measure the hours of the day as long or short, far or near, you still call it 12 hours. Because the signs of time's coming and going are obvious, people do not doubt it. Although they do not doubt it, they do not understand it. Or, when sentient beings doubt what they do not understand, their doubt is not firmly fixed. Because of that, their past doubts do not necessarily coincide with the present doubt. Yet, doubt itself is nothing but time.
So, he's saying we usually take time for granted, right? We can't measure the hours of the day as longer or shorter, even though they might feel so subjectively. Right? Sometimes time drags, sometimes it speeds. But we can't measure that difference. The signs of times coming and going are obvious in our daily lives. We don't doubt it. But we don't understand time, he says. Or sometimes maybe doubt arises, but then we forget. So there's this uncertainty and instability in our relationship to time, and that itself is manifesting in time. It is time. It is what he calls being time. Okay, let's keep going. Paragraph 4? Yes, Chenille?
The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. See each thing in this entire world in a moment of time. Things do not hinder one another, just as moments do not hinder one another. The way-seeking mind arises in this moment. A way-seeking moment arises in this mind. It is the same with practice and with attaining the way. Thus, the self setting itself out in the array sees itself. This is the understanding that the self is time.
Thank you. So now he's teaching us about the self manifesting as being time. This expression, the self arrays itself, is kind of curious. And I noticed the commentaries seem to avoid explaining or paraphrasing it. Another translation says, we set the self out in array and make the whole world. And another one says, we put ourselves in order and see the resulting state as the whole universe. So what does that really mean? I'm going to take a try at it, at a paraphrase, and say, when we align our awareness with the true boundlessness of existence, we see that it is the whole world.
Would you repeat that, please?
When we align our awareness with the true boundlessness of our existence, we see that it is the whole world, that our existence is the whole world. So we see that each thing manifests in a moment of time, and this is called, Dogen calls this a Dharma position. Dogen says that these moments of being time, or Dharma positions, do not hinder each other because they co-arise. This is quite paradoxical. They're simultaneously independent and completely interconnected. But in that moment, they co-arise. They don't hinder each other. Katagiri Roshi, who is a young Japanese monk, when he first came to the United States to help Suzuki Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center, and then later established quite a network of Zen centers in Minnesota, he has a commentary several chapters in one of his books on Uji, and he calls these moments, these Dharma positions, he calls them pivot points, and I kind of like that, where this small constricted self that we conventionally, from which we conventionally operate, this small constricted self turns, pivots, and opens to the boundlessness of existence. Dogen says that this awareness of boundless reality, that from this awareness, from even glimpses of this awareness, arises what we call way-seeking mind, or bodhicitta, which is the aspiration to awaken not just for oneself, but for all beings. And I would extend that to say, out of an awareness that's the only way we can awaken, is together with all beings, because that's our nature, is to be one with all beings, and that we awaken with and for all beings. So that arising of that aspiration is called bodhicitta, or way-seeking mind. And Dogen continues to say, practice and realization also arise in that same way as being time, not as a linear progression, not starting from aspiration, practice, realization, as a realization or enlightenment as the culmination. He's saying, no, these arise, co-arise, always in dynamic presence. So in that moment of arising, of aspiration, realization is there. In practice, realization is there. It's not, you know, countless eons away from us. Let's keep going and see. Because this is not, it's not easy to, as I said, understand this with our rational mind. Can someone read number 5?
Know that in this way there are myriads of forms and hundreds of grasses, all things, throughout the entire earth. And yet each grass and each form itself is the entire earth. The study of this is the beginning of practice. When you are at this place, there is just one grass, there is just one form. There is understanding of form and beyond understanding of form. There is understanding of grass and beyond understanding of grass. Since there is nothing but just this moment, being time, the time being, is all the time there is. Grass being, form being, are both time. Each moment is all being. Each moment is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment.
Thank you. So now Dogen is extending our view of being time to include everything, everything in the phenomenal world. In Zen language, the myriad forms and beings are called the 10,000 things, or grasses. Grasses means everything, all the particular manifestations of form in the world are grasses, or the 10,000 things. And not one single blade of grass exists except in this vast web of interconnection with all other phenomena throughout space and time. As Dogen says, there is nothing but just this moment. Since there is nothing but just this moment, being time is all the time there is. Grass being, form being, are both time. Each moment is all being. Each moment is the entire world. Reflect now whether there is any being or any world that is left out of the present moment. Just keeps going, right? The great poets and mystics of the world have experienced this, whether it's not necessarily just Buddhists, right? Great Japanese woman poet Izumi Shikibu from, I believe, the 11th century wrote, "Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." And Hakuin Zenji, the great Japanese Rinzai Zen master of the 17th century, in his Song of Zazen, says, "Truly, is anything missing now? This very land is the pure lotus land, this very body, the Buddha." So they're all echoing the same truth. And William Blake, of course, wrote, "To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." Right? Dogen wrote in another fascicle, different one, called Not Doing Wrong, he wrote, "Someone who has come to know a single particle knows the whole universe, and someone who has penetrated real dharma has penetrated the myriad dharmas." "One who has penetrated one real dharma has penetrated the myriad dharmas." The word dharma is usually used to refer to the Buddha's teachings, but it's also used like myriad dharmas, dharma as phenomenon. And that's how he's using it here. So I'm going to read you one more poem from Lia Purpura. And it's called Relativity. "Shade can chill or relieve, and sun comfort or oppress, depending on what you need to shed or retain, which is nothing as simple as sin being dark and grace light. Filaments in a web can be both invisible and bright. Each thing's its own partner, each always both, depending on where you stand. Not so central, not so always commanding." Shall I read that again? Relativity. "Shade can chill or relieve, and sun comfort or oppress, depending on what you need to shed or retain, which is nothing as simple as sin being dark and grace light. Filaments in a web can be both invisible and bright. Each thing's its own partner, each always both, depending on where you stand. Not so central, not so always commanding." Sometimes you run into a writer or a poet, I think they're closet Buddhists. Even though they don't say so. So, what I'd like you to do now, this might be a little scary, but I'd like you to take a paper and something to write with. And I'd like you to write your own version of that, of Yao Shan's verse. You can paraphrase it, you know, put it in contemporary language. You can pick some of those seeming opposites that are manifesting in your life right now, or in our world. Just play around with that, and don't worry about being literary. You can just sketch some notes even for yourself, but put it in, you know, language that is meaningful to you.
Is this going to be shared or?
You are not going to be obliged to read this to someone else, but you are going to get in small groups and talk about it.
You mean the entire page?
No, I'm talking about the verse, the opening verse.
Okay. Right at the top, right?
Yeah, where is it? The one that I translated. Just
number one.
Number one is the sort of prosy version, yeah. So, yeah, you can paraphrase it, you can put it in words that are meaningful to you, you can write your own version. Just play around with that for a few minutes, and then we'll get in small groups and just have some discussion. Okay?